This is Geek Speak, episode 32 of season 16. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer, micro farmer, and political junkie. Are we still going with micro farmer? I thought we dismissed that last week.
I thought we dismissed it before you even said it the first time.
Okay, so there's a document in front of you, and you can edit that. We also have Dr. Don Motika, a functional medicine and integrative primary care doctor in Santa Cruz, and a podcaster of the wonderful program Ask Dr. Don. How is it going podcasting, Don? Welcome.
Well, it's really different, of course, because we used to have a radio program with calls coming in.
Yeah.
And that's what I miss. I miss those calls.
You miss those voices.
I miss those voices.
Are you doing questions, though? Are you taking questions?
I'm doing emails, yes.
Yeah.
So anyone who has a medical question or wants to do that, you can just go to www.askdrdon.com.
Yeah, and we'll link to it from today's show. And I think it's actually always on the sidebar of geekspeak.org.
Oh,
I know. There's a lot of love here.
Aww.
We started from the same station. We also have Ben Jaffe, and Ben is a programmer and world traveler and musician and a video geek. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. It's good to see you.
Good to see you too.
All right, we're going to start off the program today with Miles, and he's going to tell us a little bit about the beauties of electronic voting. Is that what you're talking about?
Not necessarily about electronic voting, although that is an issue. Right now, this is from an article by Bruce Schneier, a security expert that we've covered quite often, a luminary in that field. In cryptography, that is, where right now we've had in the news a lot of information about hacks of the DNC, hacks of Hillary Clinton's emails, hacks of this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
The Republican National Convention had some Wi-Fi hacks. People put up Wi-Fi hotspots, starting up as free Wi-Fi, and a bunch of delegates connected to it, and it was really just siphoning information from them. And so what he has brought up in this blog is the security of our election systems. And that is not just the voting machines, but everything leading up to that in terms of that political process. So what do you do if a foreign government can hack a particular political party to give them a disadvantage, you know, giving advantage to the opposition party in a way that benefits that foreign entity rather than for the benefit of the country itself?
I mean, that's what we're talking about with the Russian attack on the Democratic National Convention, right? Or committee.
Alleged but Russian attack.
It's right. Pretty – I mean, I was thinking that too. Last week I kind of covered it as alleged and kind of talked about it looked like it could be. But the stats I've seen, it's pretty clearly a foreign actor. It's pretty clearly Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Russia, excuse me.
It's a foreign actor who for some reason – follows Russian holidays.
Yeah, they follow Russian holidays at the big and even Russian time zones too for Leningrad. But it's true that it might not be. You know, and we'll probably never know, of course.
It's also true that Trump could be a rational actor. Oh, I'm sorry, that was that partisan. the issue there though is that by and large, America has not done very much to try to solve this.
Being hacked, you mean?
About shoring up our security. I mean, we've been covering Diebold voting machines for, 15 years now?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And there were just some massive holes in there, and it was taking a long time to get anywhere. And even today, you have voting machines that have the exact same issues that they had 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And they're being used and unreliably.
Yeah. And there's a good case that they're being used domestically to hack, but the fact that security on our election systems is so far behind the security of gambling systems is shameful.
Yeah, there are different incentives. There are definitely different incentives.
Well, money either way, but yeah.
Right.
Oh, you're jaded. You see politics as money?
You don't?
Well, yeah, I do, but it's pretty jaded to
politics
have that perspective.
Is about power. It's about giving out of resources and determining who gets what. Now, if you can say this in a way that is more genteel to say we're trying to make sure that resources go to the people who need them the most and that people can optimize their lives to be as fulfilled as possible.
Yeah.
Or you can just say, like, we have a whole bunch of money and we need to decide who gets the money grab fastest, which is not altogether untrue.
Election fraud is a time-honored tradition in this country. It goes back way before the technology. And I think the real game changer here is that up until recently, only the United States and a few other privileged powers were able to mess with other people's elections. Mm-hmm. And now the outside powers, because they can come in electronically, and it's all one world digitally, are able
it's
to
mess.
It's
been democratized.
It's been flattened who was that? The flattening of the world is flat. I can't think of his name, but very important book about the restructuring of the world economy over the next 20 years. And so far, he's I think I read it 20 years ago, and he's been like pretty much right.
Thomas Friedman.
Thank you. And so that's one point. And the other point I would like to make is that you don't actually have to hack the election or just the hacking of the emails. But let me put it this way. If you are in a swing state and all you do is discredit that election, it throws it to the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
Which is currently 8-8 people. So yeah. Play out that game scenario.
Yeah. Or the last time the Supreme Court decided on a presidential election.
Yeah.
Well, that was it didn't go the way I wanted it to.
Hey, Don, mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about glucose management.
Well, all right. So as an MD, treating diabetes is a big part of what I do.
Especially in the United States.
Getting to be a bigger and bigger part every day. And one of the real frustrating things with diabetics is that it's hard to predict what a particular meal is going to do to a particular individual.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been something that we've been trying to crack. But what we've got right now is effectively one-size-fits-all advice, which very clearly doesn't work. And so in this personalized medicine trend, researchers enlisted something they're calling machine learning, which I'm sure you all know more about than I do.
Well, Ben actually has a whole podcast on machine learning and data science.
I do indeed.
Called Linear Digressions.
Linear Digressions.
You're going to step in and help me not fall flat on my face then. Thank you very much.
Well, you cover the medical and he'll cover the science.
Yes. So what they did was they took 800 people. They had responses to 46,000 meals. They had them essentially take pictures of what they ate, and then humans figured out what they had eaten. They measured a great many variables. They had blood parameters, a continuous glucose monitor that did not require any action on the part of the patient. They looked at their anthropometrics. That would be things like how big is your butt compared to how big is your waistline. Men, by the way, are supposed to have a ratio of butt to gut that is no greater than 1.0. So in other words, if your waist is bigger than your butt, you're in trouble. Women mm-hmm. are supposed to have a ratio of 0.8. So they looked at those factors, which are known to affect glucose but through a number of issues, primarily insulin resistance that's created by belly fat. They looked at their gut microbiome. They did DNA fingerprinting of the gut microbiome. They looked at physical activity. Everyone wore an activity tracker. And they did
this. I like the continual study aspect of it, that they have sensors on them. They don't have to do anything besides
exactly.
take a photograph of their food. Seems like a pretty simple thing
it's
to do.
It's passive.
And 800 people with 40,000 meals, we're talking about a long period of time. How long was the study?
Let's see. Well, the first validation piece of this was, I think, just
It's 50 meals a person.
2 weeks. I think it was like a week.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it was about a
right.
week. And what they did was they created, with this information, they let a machine learning algorithm that utilized multivariate predictive algorithms. I think of it as sort of like what happens with marketing, where you followed that link. So you must want to, you know, Google and
right.
you know, the other search engines send me. When I do a search now, I get the first six things are scientific articles after mm-hmm. the ads because that's all I ever.
So it's working.
It's either that or it's something by Armani. And and the topics don't lend themselves to clothing for the most part. So
right.
we're good. But then what they did, and this is the validation step that I found fascinating, was they took 100 people who were pre-diabetic. And they predicted, based on these variables, how that person's body would handle the various meals, and were able to essentially advise people how to combine foods, how to change their behaviors. For example, okay, after lunch you need to take a 30-minute walk.
So they
started dispensing medical advice with these algorithms that was individualized to where that person stood and what made them go up, what made them go down. Sleep, you know, we've got an activity monitor, so it's like, you know, dude, you need to get to bed now. It's 11 o'clock. If you don't get to sleep now, then tomorrow your blood sugar is going to be off by a factor of 20%. Mm-hmm. And some other individual sleep might not have that kind of effect on them.
How would they know whether the person was a sleep would affect them, because they were actually also knowing how much sleep these people took?
I mean, yes,
800
exactly.
Doesn't seem like it'd be a really big sample, but I guess it was.
It was big enough to devise an algorithm, and that's important too, because a lot of these machine learning. I wanted to segue to this. Mm-hmm. A lot of the machine learning that's being done right now is genome wide association studies, which is obviously 30,000 genes, plus each one of those genes has potential for maybe 10 to 500 different variants, all of which alter the way that gene operates. And when you're looking at, say, people who developed breast cancer, you take your cohort of breast cancer patients, you need a couple thousand, and then you look at their genetics and you get these candidate genes and that might increase the risk of breast cancer by 1.8%. And it doesn't look like much, but where the field is going now is that we're starting to see that these are actually not individual genes, but they are gene suites, mm-hmm. like an office suite for software that has a spreadsheet and has a word processor.
These genes that do small percentages are actually correlated together,
and they all have the same epigenetic controls. And so maybe we'll get on to epigenetics later.
Ben,
in the program.
I know you had no chance to read this article; you just glanced at it.
Right.
You know machine learning.
Well, I can kind of give a big picture, I guess, with machine learning. Actually, in terms of genomics, the podcast that I do called Linear Digressions with this other person, Katie Malone, she's really the data scientist. I can just, translate. But we released an episode, actually not – our last one was about election forecasting, but the one before was actually about machine learning for genomics, so very relevant. But big picture, if you have a bunch of data and you want to pull some kind of meaning out of that data which is relevant to you, machine learning and data science, there's a ton of different ways of going about pulling conclusions out of data, and all of it together kind of we call it machine learning and data science and whatnot. So for this, probably, I mean, there were a whole bunch of different inputs. You listed them off a little bit earlier. And humans are really good at pattern matching when you have a relatively small number of inputs, right? But as soon as you have 10 variables or 15 variables or 200 variables, like we use this in astronomy, we use this in particle physics, right? Mm-hmm. Humans are completely useless for that, right? Finding patterns, figuring out which things are important, when they're important, all of that.
On the contrary, human beings find patterns all the time. They're
including
just not
ones
valid.
That don't exist.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. And specifically, Miles, the pedant, my words were human beings are useless for this, not human beings don't have opinions.
On the contrary, there's utility in being completely wrong.
Okay. Miles is a case in point. Go on, Ben.
Yes, indeed. Beautiful. In any case, so you've got all of these inputs. You've got the outputs because you're studying all of these different people. You've got all of these inputs. You've got their different physiological responses and all of this. And then you also have... Did it work for them? Did they crash? Were they totally fine, right? So you've got the input, you've got the output. There's something in between. The something in between is actually ridiculously complex because it's a human body, right?
Right.
But it can be modeled very somewhat crudely, but accurately enough that you can derive meaning from it.
And
just to sum up, basically what these algorithms do is they take these inputs and these outputs and they try to figure out how can I one example of what one of these algorithms might do is say, okay, I've got these inputs, I've got these outputs, how can I optimize myself to, when given these inputs, say this person's about to crash or this person's totally fine, right? And then after all that optimization is done and you've kind of verified that it kind of works, now you've got this algorithm where if you feed all these inputs in for some other person it's never seen, there's actually maybe a good chance that it's going to be able to pull some meaning out of that data.
I like that you just model it as a in and out and some messy stuff in the middle, because the truth is trying to understand what it does rationally is outside the scope of our brains.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is really a neat
feature. I'm thinking of that Gary Larson cartoon with the scientists at the board with all the math, and then in the center it says, and then a miracle happens.
Yeah.
It's almost like that.
It's a black box. Yeah. And actually, before the show, we were talking about this briefly, and you said, like, I don't really know how this works. The funny thing is, the people who make these algorithms fundamentally, like at a deep level, don't really know how this works. They know how to make algorithms. They know how to, like, there are all of these different techniques for creating these algorithms. But fundamentally, what are the algorithms doing? What meaning are they pulling out? There are ways to visualize it and everything, but fundamentally, we just don't get it because our brains are not evolutionarily predisposed to understand this.
Yeah, interesting.
So it's our first encounter with a truly alien intelligence.
It kind of is, if you call it intelligence. My friend Warren is very clear that it's not intelligence, and he has a long history, and I keep on meaning to have him on the show to talk about just this kind of thing. But it feels like an emergent intelligence, right? It feels like, because it has a large complexity and it gets some
Is a beehive or an anthill intelligence?
That's kind of what it feels like to me.
I mean,
right?
Gödel, Escherbach, and all of that. Yeah. I mean, do we want to have that conversation?
Yeah, right. I would be interested to have that conversation because, yeah. I mean, you could make the argument that human brains are just ridiculously complex algorithms.
I mean. So do you want to close out that story?
Well, basically, what I see happening is smart advice and possibly ideally coming out of your phone. In the sense of, and also just understanding your body better so that we can get rid of this variability. Because every time you crash your blood sugar, and what's at stake here are brain cells.
Is that what happens? Is the negative side effect of crashing your blood sugar?
If you crash your blood sugar, you just killed some brain cells.
What's the simplest way not to get diabetes?
Well, it depends on which type we're talking about. The type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune disease where you catch a virus and it turns your immune system on and your immune system attacks your pancreas.
So don't catch that virus. That's one.
No. Actually, the best way to avoid that one is to breastfeed. It substantially reduces.
At any age? Or
No, it has to be early.
As a child.
You have to establish a healthy microbiome. So that's really important. And, you know, anybody's breast milk will do. So people who are having difficulty breastfeeding, you know, breast milk can be donated. It can be purchased. It's worth thinking about going out and getting some for your kid. We are so far away from being able to design a substitute that we can add to formula do the imprinting. And remember, when we start talking about machine learning and all the iterations, we've got thousands of different species all sending out all kinds of chemical signals, interacting with each other constantly, something along the level of a brain forest, right inside us.
Okay.
And it turns out it affects everything. So if you invite me back, I'll talk more about the microbiome.
Okay. We definitely have a lot of shows to talk about. Let's go ahead and, Ben, you want to close that? Are you good?
No,
okay,
that's
good. Will you
good.
Tell us kind of one of your side hobby passions is noise canceling, and I guess there's a new story from Amazon. Well, you've talked a lot about noise canceling headphones, and whenever you do, you kind of smile and your eyes get warm.
But that's because he can't hear me anymore.
That's true, actually. Yeah.
What's Amazon?
You have a low voice. So Amazon actually made a patent for noise canceling headphones that could automatically turn off when they detect certain sound patterns, and that could be some kind of a signal, that could be a voice, that could be someone saying, "Hey Ben," right? Ideally, I'd like to be able to hear whatever the person says. I think that's a really interesting idea. We're kind of in a strange place with this right now, because if you're just talking about the noise canceling headphones and the noise canceling part of it, you can still hear through the noise canceling headphones. It's very good at counteracting the lower frequencies, which is why it's wonderful on an airplane.
It's good at canceling consistent frequencies, right? A frequency that doesn't alter very often. Like I do noise cleaning on this show, if we have a consistent hum, I can sample that and then remove that from the feed relatively easily.
Right.
If it's not
so I'm not super familiar with exactly how all of this works, but I don't imagine that would actually I imagine it's mainly the frequency, because the way that they work is they have a microphone on the outside and they listen to the sound that's coming in about to hear your ear, hit your ears, and then they produce an opposite waveform with the speaker cone. Mm-hmm. And so the pressure wave that's in the process of going into your through your headphone and about to go into your ear gets canceled out by the pressure wave created by the headphone speaker cone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if the sound is changing a lot, I mean, the microphone's just going to do what it normally does and cancel that out. But the high frequencies are really hard to cancel out because they're so fast. So the higher you go, the higher the frequency is. So the faster the air is moving back and forth.
And right? The faster all the system has to be to counteract that.
Exactly.
Right.
So if you have a system which has a speed limit, it can't go faster than some amount or something. I mean, you just can't address, you can't cancel out higher frequencies.
Yeah. Is this the Amazon patent? Are they dealing with higher frequencies?
No.
Oh,
no. The Amazon patent is when someone says, "Hey Ben," or whatever that phrase is.
They remove that phrase.
They turn off the noise cancellingness so that way you can hear the person. So what I was saying is, if it's just noise canceling, I don't know. You can hear through the noise canceling headphones but if you're playing music, that's actually different, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
If you're walking down the street and your friend is like, "Hey Ben, what's up?" I mean, I'm not going to hear them. This happens at work all the time, where the person across from me is like, "Hey Ben, I have a question," and I don't hear them, and
because
I've got
of noise
canceling,
because of music. So you're saying that they could detect that sound and amplify that sound more than they remove that sound,
or they could just turn off the noise canceling and
aspect.
Turn down your volume.
Yeah,
that's another possibility. But
it's funny. I was thinking matching up to a car horn would be useful.
Right.
Watching people kind of obliviously walk across the street when I'm trying to make a left turn and not kill them.
That's hearing brakes, you know, tires
screeching
screech,
of brakes,
you know.
Yes.
Well, yeah, that's true. If you're hearing tires screech, it's probably too late. But
okay, so I have a question, and this is going to date me, but I suppose I've already dated myself, so it's fine.
You had to go to school for a serious amount of time.
A very long time.
Unlike us. Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
Back in the day, the early tape recorders had a sound recognition. And so when it was very, very quiet in a room and you were during lectures, and I listened to a lot of lectures where the hiss went up massively when there was silence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because it's this very simple electronic.
Yeah, it's called AGC, automatic gain control. And basically the system is always trying to keep that volume up. You'll hear it all over the place. Why on radio you have to be really careful about how you operate with the mic, because the system will actually compensate and it'll get noisier and noisier. Yeah.
Right.
So analogous to the noise canceling, except kind of this is noise amplification. Is the circuit, is in this case, they're just turning up the gain on the mic. But I wanted to know if you think that it would be possible to build a processor that would pattern recognize, so that, okay, you've got the burr of the airplane, and then you can basically hit a thing that said, "Sample that baby."
Mm-hmm.
And
move that baby.
And, you know, remove that sound.
Right, right.
Our brains do this.
I thought a lot of them did that already, that they found the steady pattern and was able to remove that.
Definitely.
But it didn't take out the things that were abnormal.
Spiky. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of research in this. Unfortunately, babies crying are very high-pitched sounds.
Yes.
So regardless, you're not going to be able to cancel it very well.
And vary a bit. It's like they're designed to make you hear them.
They're designed.
It's amazing.
Designed not to be ignored.
Yeah. Yes. Well, there's probably some survival value in that.
Probably.
Evolutionarily.
Yeah. There is some research in this, though, in terms of separating sounds, but it's a very difficult thing to do. If you watch, have any of you seen CSI? Crime Scene Investigator, that there's always the weird, like, horrible scientific sections where they're like,
Moonbase, or
can
what?
You just
one?
Separate out the sound of the car that you're in, the tape recorder was in, and the car that's pursuing them? Can you just separate that out? And the engineer is like, "Oh, of course.
Yeah, this is just easy magic.
Done." Yeah.
Click, click, click. Yes.
And it sounds a little subdued, but it's.
And everybody that
and I am deciding
like,
to kill this person.
Yeah.
And everybody that does sound engineering goes, "No. That doesn't work that way.
It doesn't
That's
work.
15 hours and it sounds horrible at the end."
Or it's just fundamentally not possible. Yeah. There have been, there's some software called Melodyne. There's actually a bunch of these, but I don't remember the other names of them, that will actually let you do like modify, separate out different sounds and then modify them as well. So like you guys have probably heard of autotune.
Sure.
So if you're singing really badly.
Yes, right.
Miles, you know, that's not an imitation. Miles, that's not an imitation.
Love at love.
Come on.
Yeah, right.
You watch it. So, I'll see you. I'll raise you muskrat love and you will hate me.
So
no, what, I will love and adore you.
We the episode ended early that evening.
We take that signal.
As Ben ran screaming.
We take that signal that maybe most people don't want to hear. And we can take that signal and snap it to different notes, so that way the person is always in tune, right? Mm-hmm. And if you listen to some like Madonna, Die Another Day, for example, they use that to ridiculous effect to create like a type of feeling, but it's used in almost all music, all produced music, I should say. But Melodyne and some of the other software out there actually will take a guitar strum where you've got several different strings vibrating and playing different notes and let you isolate those strings and move them a
yes.
little bit.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time it actually works well enough. It's really complicated, though.
Can it remove that little annoying buzzy sound that people make when they don't play the guitar?
Oh, no,
that's well?
You just got to get better at playing guitar or have the action adjusted on your guitar.
Don't you hate work. It when you hear that sound and then you just can't not hear it?
Let me tell you a story about that. William Ackerman, I loved his music. And then Charlie says, I can't stand it because of that buzzy sound, which I had not heard.
No.
He killed that musician.
He taught
you
to hear that.
He taught me to hear it. Yeah. And I could never, you're right. You
it's
can
like
never
when you learn how to taste wine.
To unhear it.
You can't unring a bell.
I will say something about what happens over time to married couples, and this takes about 30 years.
Okay.
But there's been some really interesting research, and they go selectively deaf to the dominant tones in each other's voice.
I've heard
and,
this.
And you can
they
do,
hear each other.
And you can do single-tone audiometry with them, and they will drop when you get to the peak. Because everything can be reduced through Fourier analysis
right.
to a series of very characteristic wave tones.
Yeah.
And those tones that are your spouse's voice, you will have a different threshold for hearing those. So your brain is actually turned down by up to 30%
your
ability to perceive those tones.
So it's not the actual ear canal and the actual pickup. It's actually the processing of
right.
the data.
Right. This is central. This is happening
right.
in the temporal, presumably in the temporal lobe, which
and
is
so
the
auditory. And so that test that you were talking about is you play a single frequency, boo, and you say, can you hear that? You play
you
it maybe
say,
really quietly.
You play it quiet and you turn it up and you say, tell me when you hear it.
Boo.
And then as soon as you hear it, you tell them exactly.
So right, and then people, certain pitches you just can't hear
does
anymore.
Does this mean people's audio that doesn't change like this get divorced? And so basically you have to have this feature to stay married for 30 years? How long have you been with Charlie?
Especially if you had kids.
It's a mystery. Yeah. And 34 years
yeah,
at this
so you
point.
Probably are deaf.
Oh, no. It's really requires, and it's clearly it's content editing.
Yeah.
Because if he's saying something that I haven't heard before, it's much easier to hear it. And if he's saying something that I've heard
this
a lot.
This is how you don't get bored with your spouse's stories. You just stop hearing them. Maybe.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of adaptive value
we
here.
We should visit this again in mid-February. It'd be fun.
What about the tones associated with your partner snoring?
Those get louder, I think.
yeah, well, you know what they say. If you love somebody, then you'll forgive just about anything. And if you stop loving them, then where they left the washcloth is a capital crime.
Yeah.
You know? So. Mm-hmm.
You done with that story? Or?
Yeah, I just
ear
want to say
plugs.
the only other. So there are a couple potential. There are a couple things that we have to get past, like technologically, before this will work. And the last thing is speech recognition. So like we've talked about on, I think last, did we talk about it last week that
we
I have an Amazon Echo?
Yeah, we talked a little bit.
I just bought an Amazon Echo.
When I was editing that, I realized we didn't cover that really well. Like you and I could talk about the Amazon Echo and developing for the Amazon Echo for like an hour, but we talked for like 10 minutes. And then at the end, I was like, we didn't really cover that really well.
Yeah.
So anyway, we'll have to talk again about that.
But in any case, sometimes it hears me and sometimes it doesn't when I say the keyword. And it's just, we're getting to the point where, like, we're almost there. We're almost there where it'll consistently hear me if
yep.
I'm within the same room as it, even if I'm, you know, sleepy and talking quietly or something. It has to get an order of magnitude better than that if you're going to hear someone hailing you on a street.
Yeah.
And also if you're going to be responding to words that are a little bit less, like, clear and easy to identify from a machine perspective as like Alexa or Amazon or Echo.
Don't you think, though, over time we'll get our machines fast enough and our software fast enough to do really good speech recognition?
Oh, I definitely think so. I think part of it is figuring out how to do it, though. It's not necessarily the speed. So, but we use machine learning to do that, actually.
Yeah, and the machine learning will be locale specific.
Oh, that's true.
Because language is changing so much and changes so fluidly that you actually have to have it learn the dialect of your immediate environment, not even just the region in terms of a city, but every family has its own quirks, has its own idioms.
Two things reminds me of this. One is I've realized lately that my children consistently don't say, no, thank you. They say, I'm good, which I find so frustrating, except that I use it as well. So there's the language changing. Anyway, and the second is that one of the arguments against, the Cory Doctorow's arguments against Digital Millennium Copyright Act has to do with, so Millennium Copyright Act has this feature where you're not supposed to backwards engineer something to figure it out because then you're breaking security and you can't share that knowledge. And the problem with that is that microcontrollers are everywhere, including soon to be in our hearing aids. And this is this pattern that he talks about. Mm-hmm. And eventually hearing aids will have speech recognition and translation capabilities, and the processor will be doing its job, except that you won't know what it does, and so you might not hear what people said. And if you're not paying attention to that space, you could alter people's perception in a pretty serious way, and that's one of the kind of scary tactics he uses for describing how bad the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is. I kind of agree with it, but at the same time, it is a little out there for something we should act upon right now.
You can just say DMCA instead of Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Thank you very much.
It's hard to say.
I want to get to you talking about sheep in a minute, because you're a farmer. No idea what the story is, but I see that the sheep.
Do they eat your microgreens?
They do.
But I first want to thank our patrons who help support our program with their monthly contributions. That's Pat Hedder, Chris Irwin, Glenn Nelson, John Winston, Alexis Chen, and Nergius Klinis. Klinis?
Send us an angry email.
You've been doing radio for longer than I have.
Okay. Nergius Klinis.
Nergius Klinis. That sounds really nice.
That's my reading on it.
And if it's wrong, send us a note. We'll know. Additionally, 15 other patrons that contribute monthly that just decided not to be thanked on air and mutilated by my horrible pronunciation. Thank you so much for supporting GeekSpeak. Since we started this a couple months ago, it's been a pleasure and a real joy to have my phone beep when people decide to start contributing. And the money that we're pulling in helps us support hosting costs and also allows us to market the show so that others may find it. So thank you very much for doing that. If you are not supporting the show or want to learn more about what we're doing, please visit us at geekspeak.org/support. All right. Sister clones? What? What's going on? Sheep and clones? I love it.
Hello, Dolly.
Yes. About what? 16, 17 years ago, he had Dolly the Sheep.
Yeah,
it's been a while. It was a while ago.
It was Dolly the Sheep.
Mm-hmm. And that was a sheep that, where a cell had been collected from stomach cells at the time, and then injected into an ovum, genes been put into a quiescent state, and then put into a separate sheep for gestation, and we were like, "Woo, the first clone! It's Dolly the sheep."
Because those were a lot of big words you said, but effectively, they cloned a sheep,
right? And they made sure that they did all those different steps, that you had three different sheep involved, so that you know that when the sheep comes out and it looks exactly like the source sheep, that you weren't just playing around with, you know, two randy sheep in the back corner. They were actually
that'd be embarrassing, wouldn't it? We cloned a sheep. Oh, it's not the same genome. Darn it!
It takes a village.
One of the problems, though, was that Dolly died an early death. She was 6.5 years old, died of a very nasty lung infection, and also had arthritic problems, all sorts of things that were associated.
Prematurely.
Yes, all sorts of things that were associated with old age. The thought process being that the telomeres that shorten over time as you have DNA replication did not regenerate, as it were, in the rebirthing process, that they started off at the old level and then just got older.
Why didn't they just clone an infant? That would have been so much easier.
You don't learn as much, though.
No, I guess not.
One of the things you wanted to learn was what were going to be the problems from having an adult. And
so that was a nice synopsis of a story from 16 years ago.
Yes. Well, it turns out Dolly has some sisters. 13 sisters, as a matter of fact, that are genetically identical to her. And you know what? They're perfectly healthy.
Well, did they come from the original mother, or did they come from Dolly herself?
Same batch of cells that Dolly came from. Not just from the same, sheep.
So they
same
redid
batch
the experiment. They redid the experiment from the frozen cells and did it again. And they don't have lung disease.
Right.
Well, how old are they now?
Actually,
a month.
No. They are full grown, but Dolly showed health problems very early on. They were seeing some problems within 2 years.
Why didn't they just do it with a whole bunch of sheep all at
once? Yeah, but Dolly got transferred back when we didn't know how to do that well, and we didn't know what support agents to use. And, I mean, the chemistry of this has advanced so much that I wonder if it couldn't just be the support technology rather than anything intrinsic.
So possibly there wasn't a problem with the telomeres?
Telomeres.
Yeah.
This is what happens. You have an observation. You see something. You have a phenomenon or an epiphenomenon, and you come up with a nice, plausible explanation that dovetails with what you know, and then you get kind of
bias
wedded to it because it fits. And that's talking about machine learning versus human learning. We are all the victims of our bias and
pattern matching.
And once we get that bias in there, then we have confirmation bias, and we ignore things that, just like you ignore what I was talking about, you just place a lower impact on your brain to things that go contrary to your bias.
Right, and that's why we all think we're logical beings, because we can do logic and everything, but we have all of these built-in biases that we don't see.
And then election season comes along and we can't do logic.
And we see them all the time. So is it pretty clear from these sisters surviving?
They just had their ninth birthday.
So they're doing well at nine.
So they're doing well. That's great.
That's really cool.
They will be euthanized at 10 years old. And they're going to be doing necropsies to see, to see the things that they can't see when they're alive. But at the same time, at their ninth birthday, they're kind of like the 70th birthday of a human. They've had a rich life
for
that particular breed
of
sheep. It depends on the breed of sheep.
Right. Well, thank you very much. You know, the longer form discussion we're going to have today is something that I kind of preempted us with a short podcast that I released last night after hearing that KUSP went off the air. And, of course, Dr. Don, you did your show on KUSP. 18 years. We did it for 16 years on KUSP. Maybe 15 years because for last year we've been broadcasting. And when we went off air recently, after that kind of had an event in Santa Cruz and everything. But the close of KUSP for me has been very hard. But I spoke a lot about that last night in the last episode. So what are you feeling about KUSP going down?
Well, first I'd like to say that I'm trying to maintain an evolution attitude about it because there was kind of a dynamic in our local area where you have essentially not enough food for let's call it two large mammals. So we have KUSP and we have another radio station, and those are your two large mammals. And there's enough food in that environment to feed one of them, and that food being donations to your NPR station.
Listenership in general, yeah.
Right. So let's suppose, and let's continue with this sort of predator competition thing. So the competitor had some advantages. They were a little bit better in terms of their costs and their overhead. They had some free labor. They had other advantages. Some of them we could say were the standard sort of competitive stuff that you do when you're struggling for survival, and that all's fair in love and war. And if you're the loser on that, you tend to look at it and go, well, they had an unfair advantage. And so I'm trying to stay in my, okay, this is evolution, species live, species die, and this is how it works, and I can't argue with the dynamic that I am the clear beneficiary of, as a bipedal human with all of this technology surrounding me. You know?
Well, I mean, that's all well and good unless you lose in that situation.
It
that's
makes
not great
me
for
sad.
Yeah.
It makes me sad. And I'm struggling to get traction on my podcast because a lot of my audience is older than your core audience. And so they have unfamiliarity with podcasting. It doesn't come natural to them. No. They're the generation that some of them, you know, grew up listening, the older ones, you know, grew up listening to the radio and didn't even have a television in the house when they were children. Now, think about that. Think about growing up where your sole form of access to the greater world is a talking box.
Yeah.
And there is no visuals. And you develop...
You say to folks that are listening to a podcast.
Well, yeah, because podcasts are the... last surviving, and I listen to a lot of podcasts, and that's actually where it's gone, because there is a need for storytelling. There is a need to listen to dialogue. And a lot of times, actually, visuals are somewhat distracting, and you can't do something else while you're watching a video. Yeah. And the thing I love about podcasting, and most of my audience, is you can be washing the dishes, you can be exercising, you can be...
commuting.
Doing laundry, commuting, especially commuting. Oh, my God. In Santa Cruz now, that checks up a chunk of anyone's day.
Sure.
So I don't believe that that spoken voice intimate connection is going away.
No, in fact, it's exploding. Right?
It's exploding because the inputs, and back to the large mammals. So what we've got is, instead of two large mammals, we've got equaling a biomass of, let's say, 4 tons, what we've got is 4 tons of mice scurrying around, each one of these mice being a different individual podcast that develops an affinity with a different listener group.
And from an evolutionary perspective, that's actually beneficial, right? Because you get more diversity.
It's called an adaptive radiation, and you usually see it after a major climate change, which is exactly the sort of stuff Eric Topol talks about when he talks about disruptive evolution. So the internet and everything that it's brought to us is a huge disruptor of the status quo. I think we can all acknowledge that. So as I said, I feel very sad. For me, it's a personal loss, and I'm having to scramble to figure out what my food chain looks like or my influence
your
chain or whatever, whatever you want to call it. You know, you get invested. Emotionally, I'm invested in continuing to, you know, be able to bore people with my opinions.
Well, that's
and
why we invite
them,
you here.
And teach them science while I'm at it.
You know, I just want to, for people that are not in the area, most of our audience now is all over the world. There's not an isolated population. I guess it's probably a little denser in California. But we were talking, the other great mammal, if you will, in the area that KWSP was in is Kazoo, K-A-Z-U. And it is a community service of California State University in Monterey Bay. So it's housed in Monterey Bay College. And of course, they play PRX content, PRI content, NPR, BBC, and American Public Radio. And for those people that came from KWSP listening to our programs, you hear those names because KWSP is running the same thing. And of course, there's a lot of debate in the people that have been, in fact, the founder of KWSP, Don Mussel, quite a bit of debate on whether there was another ecosystem that could have been surviving in that space, like a music-only service of that nature. But as people have been very involved in the organization for quite a long time, and your husband was on the board for years making sure KWSP ran, I see a lot of great intention and a lot of smart people working really hard, and it still failed. And so I tend to believe that it's more of a structural form of the region, of the environment and all that, that kind of caused the problem, less than wanting to blame individuals who are trying to do good. So
that's been
my take on it to some degree.
But that's the problem, is emotionally when we're disappointed, we look for a scapegoat. We look for someone to blame. And it's very – and, you know, that's why thinking about it as a systems dynamic, that we're all sort of victims of the dynamics. Anyone who goes to Thanksgiving – this is the metaphor I like to use. You go to Thanksgiving dinner and you kind of know what your family dynamic is going to be at Thanksgiving. And sometimes they can be pretty annoying and repetitive, and you're just like, oh, God, I got to go. But – you know, I really wish that Uncle Charlie wasn't coming, or Aunt Veru or whoever, because I know what I'm going to hear. I really don't want to hear it. And I don't want to get pulled back into my 17-year-old rebellious self, which is exactly what my stepfather does to me.
Right.
And so you can, get sucked into dynamics, and anyone who's ever worked for a corporation knows you have a role, and that role has a serious gravity. It entrains you in certain directions. Yeah. And then in another environment, you might be a rather different person. Yeah. And we have to accept that we are, in fact, not captains of our own ship, that, that we are entrained by outside stimuli all the time and by constraints which are not of our own making.
Hey, Miles, why did KOSP fall apart? I was hoping you'd be like, you know, witty, pingy, kind of
one-liner.
Nasty.
We were hoping for that one.
I was actually thinking because some people were having too much fun and not looking at the money. And I mean, this includes myself. Like, I loved being on Geek Speak. I loved doing that. But still, there was not that involvement in the day-to-day, at least for me. I'm just speaking for me personally.
Sure.
In the day-to-day grind of the station itself, you know, I wasn't ever on the board. I didn't attend meetings regularly. That
you just dedicated 4 hours of your week for 15 years. That's all. Come on. Like, how much do you – I mean
– But that's the thing, though. It was very much the – this is the part that I enjoy and this part that I see. And I didn't spend as much time on the things that I – that need to happen, but – it was easy for me to ignore.
Did you listen to the podcast I did yesterday?
I have not yet.
So one of the things I kind of said was about you know, death and life and birth and how you when someone passes away, you have to kind of understand that them dying makes space for other people living, right? Mm-hmm. As fathers, we both know that it's kind of important to have the other generation come up through through us and so on. And I see the birth of this revolution of new amazing content like Ben's show existing because so that I want that to exist, even if we have to lose things like KOSP. To me, it's more important that the next phase happens.
I guess I saw fits and starts. I mean, the entire time that I was involved with KOSP over the last 16 years, there was a shadow on the horizon where you had, for example, when it was mostly music, a lot of folks that were, I got $300 on this pledge drive. Yeah, but it costs $1,500 to keep your part of the station running.
That 3 hours running, yeah.
Right. That's the kind of thing I meant. Like, you would, a lot of people focusing on like, hey, I'm having a great time and I had this support there, and willfully ignoring some hard realities that were not really hard to see coming. Mm-hmm. And some of it may be a failure of imagination to see how to affect it, and maybe seeing it too late, because honestly, I thought Bonnie's ideas for switching the programming around and working would have done great if she had had more time, which was...
Yeah, the other side of this, of course, is a large deficit that was owed to multiple organizations, such a large deficit that it was very hard to recover from that. Ben, did you want to say something on this?
No. I think that actually everything that's been said is... those are the things that I was thinking.
Okay, and we could get back into tech now. Is that what you think?
No. Okay. I'm enjoying this conversation. All right.
Well, there was that too. There was the focus on tech and not so much on people. And that's something that I hope that we've been able to do well with GeekSpeak is, yes, tech is around, but we always try to talk about like, how does this affect people? How are people interacting with the changes in technology?
Well, so I want to talk about NPR for a second.
Mm-hmm.
And National Public Radio, you know, started as this great news. It's very expensive to do news. It's you know, a lot of money has been invested.
Let's call
a
spade a spade. They are still a great news.
They're a great news source. Yeah. Absolutely. People want to listen to it. I listen to it. I tell my computer in my house all the time to turn it on in the morning. The thing that isn't Alexia. In any case, I'm trying to manipulate the sound. Anyway. And
you're thinking about all the people with echoes.
I am thinking.
I was actually thinking, could folks actually email us and let us know if any of our recent shows have triggered
that would be
it?
Nice to know.
Yes, please.
Because if we're not triggering you, it would make it so much easier for us not to trip over ourselves.
One person did email us and said, I was out by the pool listening, so you didn't get me.
Geeks at geekspeak.org if you want to give us feedback on that.
Yeah.
I've lost my train of thought completely.
You're talking about NPR.
So you turn it on.
So the aspect that NPR was this great resource for small community radio stations, and it provided them an opportunity to have the news, and in a commute time when you want to hear the news, it's perfect, and it's a good blend, and for years it was a very successful blend. And when KZU went to NPR and the two carriers oversected each other, KOSP and KZU, that caused this problem of having two mammals in the same space. Prior to that, it used to be a policy of NPR to only allow the service to be available per one station in a certain region. And they allowed two stations to be in the same region. And that is basically why the battle occurred.
Yeah, and then also spun a yarn about how when we've done this in other areas, both stations have done very well.
And it's hard because, of course, I want to like NPR because I listen to it all the time. I have a colleague now here that used to work at NPR, and I know people that are in the industry and appreciate it and all those great things. At the same time, that battle that took place – now, of course, one of the stations could have decided not to do that. Would have been fine. Happened because of a policy change at NPR.
So that was the catalyst.
That was – yeah, that was what allowed for the battle to some degree to happen. And so NPR has, you know, not lost in the situation, but a station has. At the same time, I don't know if the people, besides the side music show and the podcast and the, you know, Dr. Don show and Geek Speak, those things have been lost from that community. But the NPR feed, NPR itself, is not lost at all, right?
Actually, you're neglecting one community that's lost out majorly, and that's the
Big
Sur community.
That's a
because KZU does not get there.
Yeah.
And so when I used to go down to Big Sur, it was like
going back to my
hometown, small hometown somewhere. It's like, hey, Dr. Don, you know, it was really had presence there, and people depended on NPR, and the bandwidth down there is terrible.
Yep,
and that's part of its appeal. But that radio was really a lifeline, and so I think that community has suffered the most, and I'm including the KUSP. You know,
Big Sur is a beautiful coastal town south of Monterey and isolated geographically from the ocean and a mountain range.
But also the music listeners, because one of the things that, you know, think about in terms of KOSP with their association with NPR being a nonprofit, and they would pay dues into, what was it, BMG?
Yeah, something like that.
So that they could play music. You had this blanket statement, as long as you kept track of the music, then you just send off and the fees were paid.
Right.
And so for us, it was pretty easy to say, okay, we're going to set up shop, put up a few microphones, and do our talk show. For those shows that were music-based, you can't really do that. You're going to run into copyright issues.
And when your audience base does not know how to podcast, that's a serious problem too. I mean, that's exactly what Don's going through at this point too. I have to say that it feels like, I mean, you know, I have really good friends that do music programs, and there isn't a way for them to do it. Like, I don't know how they would do it. It's not, you know, financially, legally viable.
And then you have the ecosystem of what does it mean when you have Pandora and Spotify and
those were a big piece, I think, of the changes in the environment that led to declining followers, because you have attrition. You have people who die. You need to bring new people in, just like you were talking about bringing up those children. Well, you need the young adults to be listening and contributing, and they weren't in droves because there was something else that money went to,
not just Pandora. You know, we're talking about YouTube. I mean, my kids do YouTube and Facebook and all these other wonderful services that we see.
And, you know, it's so interesting to me about apps and the psychological barrier people have to paying for an app. I mean, you know, these things are like $2, $5. Seriously, it's a cup of coffee. But people want to use the free one, and they'll put up with the ads. And there's this – so there's – that's something that I hope will change. I don't know if it will. Mm-hmm. It's but the idea of, you know, that you're supposed to pay for content, that – you know, growing up in the era where you had to go out and go to a store and buy music in some sort of actual physical format gets you used to the idea deep, deep into your brain that you're supposed to pay for people's work. And that's just changing. That's another one of the many things that are changing. And, you know, what you have to do is just try to stay afloat on the sea of change and, you know, find your North Star and sail towards it.
All right. I think we're go on.
Wow, I got the last word. Cool.
Oh, you did. Ben, let's give us some geographical knowledge, would you please?
Yeah, I mean, we were just talking about where Big Sur is. Do you guys know where Australia is?
South.
South. South what? This is kind of an interesting story.
North of Antarctica, south?
So,
south of Singapore.
We know where Australia is. Mm-hmm. Humans know where Australia is because we have flights that go there. Otherwise, that wouldn't go very well. If you look at the systems that keep track of where land is, especially for things like GPS, it turns out there's actually a geocentric datum of Australia, which is the thing that keeps track of where Australia is, mm-hmm. and where things in Australia are relative to the rest of Australia. And then there's also an international system, which is our GPS thing.
So to be clear, the way GPS works, of course, we have the satellite grid,
right.
And it keeps track of where things are from perspective of where that grid is. But to sync that grid to the planet, you actually have to have locations on the planet that you know the location of.
Right.
And it used to, and there's other systems that do this. It used to be that GPS actually falsifiedly told you a wrong location. And one of the service of RDS, which was Radio Digital Service, it's a subcarrier of the FM brand that KWSP used to run before yesterday, would actually tell the carrier that was broadcasting 88.9, KWSP, would actually have a subcarrier. The location of that carrier was known. And the delay between that carrier's frequency to where you had your GPS, you could actually figure out that delay, and then you could compensate for the GPS lie. The government years ago stopped lying with GPS data because we were just compensating
for it.
And
the government was, I mean, were they were lying for like strategic reasons,
yes.
Like we don't want you, a citizen, to use this system as well as we, the government, can.
Right.
But for military reasons, I think were the main-sided reasons.
Right. And the commercial industry just figured out a workaround by using terrestrial radio. But anyway.
Right.
That's fascinating.
So we've got the international GPS system, right? And then Australia's got its own system. And Australia's system was working great. And the international system was working great. The problem is that Australia, the entirety of Australia, is very slowly moving.
That's awesome.
So these two systems that are working great, completely great on their own, are slowly falling out of sync with each other.
Does that mean if you flew and kept track of GPS the entire time, it would go boop and pop difference? Or is it more complicated than that?
I don't exactly know the specific ramifications of it, but suffice it to say, if you have two systems for global tracking and they're slightly out with each other and they're getting worse and worse and worse,
how much, you
probably want to correct this.
How much does Australia move?
Australia moves, I have that number, 11 centimeters, sorry, hold on, boop, 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 boop. Where is it? Okay, so this article, another article had the number for Australia, but the continent is moving north by 7 centimeters each year and is colliding with the Pacific plate, which is moving west 11 centimeters per year. So
wait, it's going 11 centimeters per year north?
Seven centimeters.
7 north, 11 west.
Okay.
Different plate.
I don't think it's actually 11... west. I think it might
it's
just
hitting
be
a plate that is traveling 11 west.
It's confusing reporting the way that they wrote this. It's not very clear.
But it's moving in an amount that we know. It's not like some amount that you can't tell.
It's like half a centimeter every month.
Yeah, that's,
which is very slow, but I mean
7 centimeters in some circumstances can be a disappointment, but circumstances it's not noticeable.
There's the story
can't we just
of
do
the,
a synchronized watches moment where you go to this structure which is presumably not moved in the last year and you beam up a signal to the satellite and say, "Here I am, reset."
You'd think you'd be able to do that.
We know this shift. We know what the shift is and we know we're keeping track of it, right? It's not that we don't have the ability to actually measure it, it's that our two systems
don't automatically sync.
Are not automatically syncing.
Australia's
system has no reason to say, everything has moved north by this amount, every day or something like that, because it's just Australia's system. So
the
actually,
rest of the world has shifted south.
Right. That's exactly right. So they are having a synchronized watches moment where they are changing the location of Australia with respect to these two systems.
Wait, did you just make a Parker Lewis Can't Lose reference?
Yes, I did, and I didn't get it, but you got it. Good job. I'll pat you on the back. But anyway, they are having that moment. And the interesting thing is that because this is a continual shift, they're actually overcompensating. So they're moving it more than they need to, so that way it'll be out of sync the other way, and then Australia will catch up with the systems.
They're being lazy.
So it's based on projection. No, well, I don't know. Based on projections to 2020, so next year the data will be out by about 20 centimeters, and then 2020 it'll pass, and then it'll keep on going. And then a couple years after that, I'll report on another story where we do the exact same thing.
Okay.
Don, it's kind of like a leap second thing, but geographic.
Don, I know you've got an article in front of you that you want to cover, and you've covered so well, but earlier you were talking about epigenetics, and you say that on your program quite a bit, but I have neglected to put in my permanent memory resources what epigenetics is. Would you enlighten me?
I actually stopped you guys from talking. I'm like, guys, let's talk about this on the show, because this is just too interesting.
Okay, well, epigenetics 101, because it's definitely an onion, so we could dig pretty deep, but let's start with the fact that we've only got 30,000 genes, which is way less than a lot of much more primitive organisms. So there must be some additional way of slicing and dicing and playing with these genes, so because we are fairly elaborate, and yet we don't really. So it's kind of like a condensed book.
Is that the whole thing? Like, oh, we have the same amount of genes as a mouse, things like that.
No, we have less.
We have less.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fewer.
So, sorry.
Fewer.
Oh. We have fewer.
Hey, I caught
Thank
that
you.
In an email recently, and I was writing and I wrote less. And I was like, "Oh, miles! Oh, fewer
miles!"
Thank you very much.
Thank
I
you.
Actually got something from you once. Thank you.
Thank you. There you go. Well,
pet peeve. Sorry.
That's all right. With these fewer genes, we manage quite well, and also a lot of genes have sort of different properties throughout the lifespan. So let's take, for example, a gene called MYC, which is really important during embryology. And we were talking earlier about embryology a little bit before the program. And those genes, in context of being a growing cell that's turning into a cluster of cells that's then turning into something that looks rather like a salamander and then turning into something that looks rather like a human, those genes turn on and off, mm-hmm. and they do it in a very coordinated fashion, driven by things like chemical gradients. And then they're supposed to stay off for the rest of their life. And so there are several ways that you silence genes. You can turn them on, you can turn them off. And biochemically, you can throw methylation, which is CH3, on the promoter site, which is the start signal. All genes, just like when you program, there's kind of a – there used to
a
be.
I don't know
if there's – you know, this still exists because I haven't programmed since college. But, you know, you had essentially a C colon, and that said, we're starting a program. And so the genes have that, and that starter signal can be turned on or turned off. And essentially, if it's turned off by dropping a methyl group on it, then that gene cannot be started. It will not be transcribed.
Okay.
Methylation is this really complicated process, does a whole bunch of things in your body. So just putting a plug on the start signal is one form of epigenetics. And when you are born with your identical twin and one of you becomes a Seventh-day Adventist and doesn't smoke or drink, and the other one becomes a stripper and smokes and drinks and does all kinds of terrible stuff.
Thanksgiving gets really difficult.
Then if you look at their genetics and you look at their methylation on their genome 30 years out, they look like two completely different individuals.
Whoa,
because
really?
They've got all these genes that are turned. One's got certain genes turned on, one's got certain genes turned off.
From their life difference.
Right. And you look at their bodies and you look at the faces and you go, oh, yeah, right.
And one looks great.
One's, you know, what's the old expression, rode hard and put up wet, you know? So you see that divergence in humans. The identical twins are kind of an example of that. So methylation's one thing. Histone acetylation, which is where you put an acetyl group, also a very similar chemical group, on a spool and essentially lock the DNA onto the spool. So it can't unspool and it can't be read.
Isn't that basically the fact that they both do the same thing? They kind of stop that gene from
they
going?
They stop, and sometimes they stop a suite of genes from going. And then there's other forms of epigenetics. So one I was just reading about.
I'm sorry. So what's the in epigenetics, what's the cause of that, of one of those occurring? Like what causes that to happen?
There's a complex editing system that's going on.
Is that controlled by genome?
Well, ultimately, the editors are part of the genome in the sense that they get created, transcribed, and become these editor programs. And this is very, very complex stuff going on at the surface of the cell, rather like analogous to those Rube Goldberg devices where, you know, you light the candle, it burns through the thread, that flips up a ramp, the bowling ball rolls down the ramp.
Really complicated systems.
Really complicated systems with multiple feedback loops at each level that allow for amplification or that allow for an effect to dampen out. So this is elaborate controlling structure that we're just now beginning to see. We had to, first of all, we had to decode the genome and go, wait.
There's not enough here.
We've been looking at the exons. We haven't been looking at the introns. The introns turn out to be 90% of the genome. That's where the action is. So we decoded the genes, but we a lot of the DNA that we decoded wasn't genes. But what it is, in fact, are sophisticated controlling molecular machines that that read the input. Like, for example, if I put an estrogen on a surface of a cell, that estrogen will be able to penetrate the cell. It goes straight to the nucleus. It goes inside the nucleus, and it sits on a promoter region. And it'll turn on a whole suite of genes on multiple different chromosomes, cause them to unwind, cause them to be transcribed. Then after they're...
Where did that estrogen come from?
It came from my bloodstream.
Okay, but so your body did create it. The genetics created the thing that... I mean,
it's a feedback loop.
It is a feedback loop.
So, and it's
okay,
a,
so then
it's
a whole
complete,
bunch of things get
it's
turned
a complete
on
bootstrap.
That cell. Right.
It's a complete fascinating... bootstrap device.
And
somewhere along the way, we shifted, and we are very, very close to chimpanzees. That's probably our closest neighbor genetically. But if you, for example, look at the number of copies of things, we might have 10 copies of a gene, and the chimpanzees only have 2. And that gene might be for something that we do a lot better than chimpanzees, like speech, some aspect, some gene that's been identified as having something to do with the structure of the vocal cords, or the way we hear, or the way we see. So there are all these multiple levels of control. We're just beginning to scratch the surface. But we can alter our epigenetics. And the science allows us to see, okay, what environmental input does this, and then we can alter the environmental inputs and essentially reprogram our own cells through our behavior.
So that whole field of looking at the complexity structures around how genes get turned on and off and how that system is called epigenetics.
That's right.
Okay. Cool. I think that's good for the 101, excuse me. That was awesome.
And actually, I just have a quick thing just so I know my own nomenclature. Is this also that field, the things that we were ignoring for the large part because they were control structures or the like, what used to be called abusively junk DNA?
Junk DNA. Yeah. DNA turns out to be actually the machinery.
It's actually useful.
It's extremely. It's the factory. The output. It's what makes the car. The factory. The output. Our genes are effectively the car. But the, I mean, sorry.
That's
the
a
products
really cool
of
way
our
of
genes.
It.
The exons. The oh, this protein is coded for here. I've got to stop waving my hands around.
Well, Don, that was awesome. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Miles, tell us about solar cells.
Well, a group has. This is University of Illinois at Chicago, have worked out a solar cell capture that produces a hydrocarbon, a burnable hydrocarbon. So doing essentially what trees might do, which is taking sunlight, going through a catalyst, capturing the CO2 from the air, and synthesizing it into carbon chains,
okay.
You know, stripping the oxygen off and making carbon chains.
Like a leaf.
Yes, except that here it's not making a leaf, it's not making a bark structure, it's making what we would use as fuel. And the reason I wanted to bring up the story was, while as exciting as it may be, I'm actually curious about this because one of the things we don't want to do is just re-burn it again. That's just CO2 coming out of the atmosphere, CO2 goes back in. It's not as bad as digging up carbon and burning it into the atmosphere.
Well, you've got to have a substrate. I mean, you can't
make carbon
out of a photon. So how's that work?
You pull it out of the air.
Well, see, that would be where you would read the paper done by University of Illinois at Chicago.
I see.
Oh, and we're going to post the reference.
Yes. Okay. But it is something that is new. I am curious. There are a couple questions I have. One is it a net gain over having just straight solar voltaic? In other words, having it just convert straight to electricity. At the same time, if you are making a hydrocarbon fuel or hydrocarbon sink, that becomes a like a battery. I mean,
yeah, it's much more portable.
Yeah.
Oh, no. You're missing something here. Okay, hydrocarbons are, you do more with hydrocarbons than burn them. Okay, that's
right.
Drugs. You build medicines.
Yes.
So having a solar cell that would actually be able to build hydrocarbons has huge implications for space travel, because where your energy source in space is either nuclear, which you know has its issues, or it's the sun. And if you can do biosynthesis off of the sun and bypass the plant piece of it, which takes up a lot of space, mm-hmm. and you might be able to get to a point where you could use sunlight and off-gassing from humans to biosynthesize drugs, food obviously, but mm-hmm. but more importantly is complex molecules that you would otherwise have to
run out of.
Well, ship up from the depths of the gravity well, which yeah. is making them very expensive.
Quite expensive. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, drugs and the like, I could see things that are small volume. Fuel, I don't know how useful that would
fuel
be in
wouldn't
space.
Fuel would be useful in space at all. And I'm not sure, why do we want to burn... I agree with you completely. Yeah. Why do we want to burn hydrocarbons? Seems like
a bad
idea.
Well, we don't want to, but we've been doing it anyway. So.
Well, I think we should stop.
You think maybe? Yeah.
mm-hmm. But I wonder about the efficiency of it. The efficiency, when I mean also the manufacturing process to get all the pieces together and manufacture them... how useful it would be for grabbing the carbon out of the atmosphere. And
so I just got to say, we have amazing machines that grab carbon out of the air that you can then use as fuel. They're called trees.
Trees, yeah.
And so this whole idea of like, oh, we're going to do something that it's going to be better. Unless we get a lot more efficient than growing plant life.
This can be done where trees aren't necessarily as prolific.
Mm-hmm. The Sahara Desert, for example, lots
exactly.
of sun.
Unless you need a lot of water for this process, which you might. I mean,
well, you need some hydrogen.
Yeah, but then
of course you could pull that from the atmosphere. Yeah. I don't know.
All right, cool. Thanks. And you'll have that article up at geekspeak.org, mm-hmm. I'm assuming. Do you guys hear that Uber has been trying to succeed in China for a long time, and they just partnered/sold their whole Chinese division to their competitor? So they basically lost China. That you might have seen Uber stock fall because of that. Of course, it's been traditionally very difficult to do business in China. We saw Google go in and was successful and then finally decided to get out of the process. Apple, of course, is extremely successful in China, one of the major reasons why they're still growing. In fact, last quarter earnings for Apple, if you took China out of it, they would have lost money. Not that that's really a problem because they have so much money, it's ridiculous. So in any case, that's kind of a hit on Uber a bit. It's being sold as a merger to some degree, but it's definitely a selling of their entire unit, and it goes complete to a Didi Chongqing is the competitor in China. And if you look at the rise of growth in China around the need for this, it's insanely quick. Like, it's just the curve goes up vertically. Here, Don, I'll show you the growth rate of China's transportation needs is just through the roof compared to other regions. In any case, so Uber kind of a loss. I wonder if this means they'll stop calling and pestering all the engineers here at Netflix, because I have to say Uber is the one that calls and pesters for engineers. So anyway, not a serious problem to have. But let's unless someone else wanted to mention anything about that, I want to move on to your actual story, Don, that you've been waiting to talk about. Yes,
with bated breath.
Oh, good.
Okay, so let me start by saying that. We were talking about law of unintended consequences and disruptive technologies. And one of the more disruptive technologies that has been developed in medicine in the last few years are something called biologicals. So we talked about how there's this elaborate control system. Well, it happens.
Epigenetics
yeah. is just one layer.
Okay.
There's also all of this crosstalk and coordination of information between cells. And the cells, like, for example, a white blood cell, operates very much like a fairly sophisticated vacuum cleaner. The little Roomba that I turn loose that wanders around and picks up my dog hair will come to the edge of the step and realize it's come to an edge and back off. And mm-hmm. you can imagine a white blood cell coming up to another cell and having to decide friend or foe, or you know, should I eat you? What should I do about it? And so there's this moment where the white blood cell makes that decision. It's called an immune checkpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, to me, just fascinating, is that most of your body cells carry a very specific barcode that says that I am a epithelial cell from Lyell Troxell's left index finger, distal portion. And it's actually coded to that level.
Wow.
So cells that will go around and kind of buzz the barcode to see whether or not this is a Lyell Troxell cell or whether this is potentially a foreign invader.
And we're talking about scanning the barcode. You're talking about molecular touching.
I'm talking about a molecular taste.
Okay.
If you can
All
imagine
right.
like a cell sort of going up and grappling, sticking its tongue out and, you know, licking
okay.
the cell to decide.
Have sensors to determine whether it tastes
yeah.
right. Okay.
Right, exactly.
And it's called the immune checkpoint.
This is one of the many, many examples of that. So T cells are going out and they're going to try to find cancer cells. And they find these cancer cells by finding the barcode. And there's a... cancer cells will often hide their barcodes or change them.
I mean, something's wrong. That's why they're cancer, right?
They're cancer.
Because they're not being
exactly.
cleaned up.
And they're not necessarily building the barcode exactly right, so that shows, and they get sniffed out as sort of unfriendly cells. And so that's bad for the cancers. And cancers evolve, too. And we're talking about something that's growing fairly rapidly. So they developed a new molecule called a checkpoint inhibitor, which actually prevents the T cell from buzzing the barcode.
Wait. Okay.
So it fools.
So this is a drug that you would use to.
No. This is something that the cancer cells.
The cancer
make.
Produces this.
They make it.
That says, "Stop."
I'm
sniffing.
Fine. Yeah.
I'm fine.
Stop looking.
These are not the droids you were looking for.
These are not the droids you were looking for. Precisely. Exactly right. So that's what the cancer cells do, and we're like very happy. Little researchers, and we figure out that this protein exists. And so we developed a series of drugs called PD-1 inhibitors, which inactivate the inactivator. But biology works this way. You inactivate something, and that activates it. So if you inactivate the inactivator, now the T cell is activated and attacks the cancer cell.
Okay.
And these are proving to be very promising technologies. They're grown through the use of monoclonal they're grown like monoclonal antibodies.
Okay, so the methodology here is to block the cancer's thing that it gets
is blocking.
Put
yes.
Okay.
Yes, I know.
It's a little complicated.
It is. It's recursive. It's multiple.
So
it's
does
multiple
it cause
recursive.
The cancer cell not to make that? What is it called? T
no,
cell?
No, it just covers it up so that it can't be active.
That's
so
pretty cool.
So we've built a molecule. The cancer cell builds a molecule. It's an arms race.
Mm-hmm.
We build
mm-hmm.
a molecule that blocks the cancer cell's new technology, let's say. And so that's great, right? So we can give this to people with cancers. The problem is that these checkpoint inhibitors serve a dual purpose.
Oh, yeah.
And one of them is that cell recognition. So when we start giving PD-1 inhibitors, the immune system loses one of its major breaks.
And
so
it can't scan anymore.
So what's happened is we're starting to get more autoimmune disease in people who are taking these drugs.
Mm. Even though they're effective at fighting the
they're
cancer.
They're effective at fighting the cancer, but what you do is give them a really serious case of rheumatoid arthritis.
Arthritis can be an autoimmune disease?
That's right. Rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and psoriatic arthritises are all autoimmune disease where the immune system is actually attacking the lining of the joint.
Oh, interesting.
And that causes the lining of the joint to foam up and get all calloused and sore, and it releases all kinds of destructive chemicals that destroy the cartilage, and off we go.
Right. Wow.
And so...
So it does sound like we're building Rube Goldberg machines fight these things.
We are fighting, but unfortunately sometimes our machines do a little Sorcerer's Apprentice number and run away with people's immune systems.
Sounds very familiar with taking a foreign species into a new environment to fight a beetle, right? And all of a sudden you've got a problem with
exactly the rabbits. What was it? The rabbits and the...
And the cane toads also.
Yeah, exactly.
Deal with.
Yeah.
So we're doing that in the body.
We're engaged in exactly that sort of an ecological experiment.
I would
assume
that the side effect of the immune deficiency problem emerges later. So that's why we were using these drugs for a while. Or is it just that, well,
you've got a bad cancer, you're throwing all this chemo at the person, this improves their survival. And it's like, what has he got to lose? He's got stage 4 cancer. We're going to use it on him. And then, of course, it works on that individual or set of individuals. And we're talking fairly small numbers. I mean, you'll get something approved for advanced cancer. And in fact, most of this work is done on...
Yeah,
sorry?
Like, and what's the worst thing that could happen kind of thing?
Well, you die. But then again,
right, I mean,
you've got cancer.
You might as well do it. Right,
so,
yeah.
But here's one. So, and it goes the other way. This is what I find so wonderful about this is that there's a reciprocal drug that these are called tumor necrosis alpha factor inhibitors.
It's easy for you to say.
And tumor necrosis alpha is a protein that is highly inflammatory. It turns on a whole cascade of inflammation and things that upregulate the immune system. So again, you've got a positive feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
And so in rheumatoid arthritis or other autoimmune disease, there's a great deal of upregulation of inflammatory mediators. So again, let's build an antibody to attack this thing, because we can basically build antibodies against any of these surface markers, surface receptors.
It's just a molecule that we have
It's
to
just a molecule.
Create.
We can build a molecule. It's like, you know, taking the impression of a key and then taking that to the locksmith and having him make you a key.
That's a hard way to make a key, by the way. I've done
I know. It's a really terrible way to make a key. But, you know,
But it works.
You can do it.
Yeah.
And molding, you know, doing sculpture and molds.
So if we do this, though, I mean, isn't it case that the reason the complexity exists inside our organisms is we're talking millions and millions of years of this kind of process happening. Now we're trying to do it in, you know, a year. Like, it seems like we'll have to be really fast reacting to all these different changes to be effective in any way.
What I want to bring it back to is it takes about 10 years to figure these things out because people are long-lived. And by the time the thing emerges, you've already released it, cat's out of the bag, and then you have to decide how much do we pull it back. So in the case of the tumor necrosis alpha factors, they've been out for maybe 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
They were two game changers for people with these
lived.
Autoimmune disease. Well, they weren't going to die, but they were just going to be crippled mm-hmm. and be in horrible pain for the rest of their lives. So, yeah, fairly big. And they were just amazing. Wonderful drugs, worked great. So now we start trying them on – we worked on RA. Let's try it on psoriatic arthritis. Let's try it – and then starts getting used on trivial things because that's always what happens because of the economics. Now, fast forward about 8 years ago, you know what? We're seeing higher rates of leukemia and lymphoma in people taking these drugs. First it was blood cancers, but now that we're getting out to the 15-year mark, we're realizing that – the name tumor necrosis factor, it was called that for a reason because that level of inflammation was a big part of killing cancer cells.
Mm.
And by blocking that, we've allowed cancers to slip through. So I found this latest article with the idea that the cancer cells make these drugs that are PD-1 inhibitors that prevent the cancer cell's defense mechanism from working actually cause rheumatoid arthritis. And we know that the drug that sort of pulls
helps
back
it,
the rheumatoid arthritis. And so you can think of
cancer.
The immune system as this teeter-totter.
Yeah.
Between, you know, if your immune system's too overactive, you get autoimmune disease. If it's underactive,
you get cancer. It makes sense.
And threading that needle scientifically and getting this all to work, I mean,
is the trick,
and it's not being done in a coordinated fashion,
right.
Obviously.
Well, do you think we need more sensing and more like more ability to find out where that line is? That seems like what you'd want to do. You'd want to have some kind of system in the body where you go, oh, you're leaning, you know, like a pH balance kind of thing, right? But it's an autoimmune versus cancer
balance. I think it would be possible to come up with an assay, we overshoot.
Yeah,
I think that's really
right,
the problem.
Makes sense.
It needs to be more nuanced.
So, and that's kind of how we deal with medicine in general in the United States and probably globally.
It's because we're based
is we overshoot.
Yeah,
we get really, really sick and then we handle it, not staying healthy.
Disease
the
model.
Time. Yeah,
disease model.
Which
and
is
and infectious disease you've got to remember how amazing vaccination was and how amazing antibiotics were when they first came along. I mean, they were true game changers. Mm-hmm. They were phenomenal. They were like, oh, my God.
We won.
And it's a magic bullet. And so we've gotten so seduced by the magic bullet that we keep trying to shoot things that are way too complicated to just shoot a bullet at.
Yeah.
And these complex chronic diseases, for example,
Want to be subtle with that.
You want to be subtle. I think about, you know, just reading this, you know, wonderful, wonderful science fiction book called Seven Eves, by the way.
Oh, my God. I thrashed that book. I don't like that book.
Interesting. I loved it.
And I actually
maybe it's because it's about women.
I wish it was better about. I mean, okay.
Let's
interviewed
not.
Him
we're
on
digressing.
The show. You can go listen
let's
to
that. I'll go listen. Anyway. Let's not digress too much.
But why was it wonderful? Because they talked about the science. It was a good science.
It was great. And yeah. So right now I'm rereading this. I just finished rereading the section where they, you know, take this lassoed asteroid and, you know, they're playing around with little tiny course corrections to take this big massive object to trying to get it somewhere.
Yeah, for years.
And that's what we need to be doing is, you know, little tiny burns, you know, correct the course, little burns. And we do need that kind of monitoring. And I think it's out there. It's in the form of a new science called proteomics, which is where you don't look at the genomes. You look at the proteins that are being produced. Mm-hmm. And these proteins can give us a great deal of information about what's going on in the body. And they can be obtained through a peripheral blood draw and sometimes even just a urine test.
Cool.
So I would be – I am very excited to see what comes down the pipe
there. It seems to make sense if you've got a very complicated system that shuts down genomes and pulls things apart, you know, starts things up again, that actually looking at the output of the cell of what the actual proteins are that are being created, you kind of – well, whatever the complexity is down there, this is what we have at this point, which might be actually a simpler way of looking at it.
Yeah.
And Seven Eves, of course, is by Neal Stephenson. And, of course, it's science fiction novel about the future. And I lambasted, I believe, but also interviewed him. And it was an interesting experience talking to him for like 10 minutes and trying to not insult him because I disliked it so much. So I'm going to in the future talk to you, Don, about that book.
And yes.
The thing is, a lot of people I respect loved that book. So I probably just
So there's idiot. Something wrong with you.
I would assume.
It's funny, this whole talk has been fascinating, and yet I have this glass half empty kind of aspect to it, which is no matter what we do on a long enough timeline, the survival rate drops to zero for everyone. Eventually.
And on that note, GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know that we said hello. Thanks to our intern, Chandler.
Thanks, Chandler.
And to our patrons, who I thanked in the middle of the show, thank you so much for making GeekSpeak a possibility. Our support to our support geek, Greg Merkley, who provided this week's working title, Machines Elect to Shut Down Dolly's Sisters. Theme song by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music, and thank you for being here for episode 32 of season 16, or 16th season, our 16th season, that's it is. Miles, thank you so much.
No, it's season 16.
Season 16.
Right.
Of our season, no, our 16th season. Our season 16. Oh,
yes.
Man, I gotta edit that. Yeah.
Because we have a season zero.
Yeah.
Of course we do.
Of course we do.
And Ben Jaffe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Don, thank you so much for being here. I do hope you come
been
back.
Ever so much pleasure.
Oh, good. See you all next week.